Not too long after that, but 5 time zones to the east, Jack Ryan rolled out of bed, got his paper, and switched on the TV. CNN also carried the fire story from Boston. It was a slow news night at home, and he breathed a quiet prayer for the victims of the fire, followed by speculation about the gas pipe connection in his own stove. His house, though, was a lot newer than the standing lumber yard that defined a house in South Boston. When they went big, and they went fast. Too fast for those people to get out, evidently. He remembered his father often saying how much he respected firemen, people who ran into burning buildings instead of away from them. The worst part of the job had to be what they found unmoving on the inside. He shook his head as he opened his morning paper and reached for his coffee, while his physician wife saw the tail end of the fire story and thought her own thoughts. She remembered treating burn victims in her 3rd year of medical school, and the horrid screams that went with debriding burned tissue off the underlying wounds, and there wasn't a damn thing you could do about it. But those people in Boston were dead now, and that was that. She didn't like it, but she'd seen a lot of death, because sometimes the bad guy won, and that was just how things worked. It was not a pleasant thought for a parent, especially since the little girl in Boston had been Sally's age, and now would never get older. She sighed. At least she'd be doing some surgery that morning, something that really made a difference with somebody's health. Sir Basil Charleston lived in an expensive townhouse in London's posh Belgravia district, south of Knightsbridge. A widower whose grown children had long since moved away, he was accustomed to living alone, though he had a discreet security detail in attendance at all times. He also had a maid service which came in 3 times a week to straighten up, though he didn't bother with a cook, preferring to dine out or even fix small meals for himself. He had, of course, the usual accoutrement of a king spook, 3 different sorts of secure phones, a secure telex, and a new secure fax machine. There was no live-in secretary, but when the office was busy and he wasn't there, a courier service kept him apprised of the printed material circulating in Century House. Indeed, since he had to assume that the opposition kept an eye on his home, he deemed it smarter to remain at home in time of crisis, the better to project the image of calmness. It really didn't matter. He was firmly tied to the SIS by an electronic umbilical cord. And so it was this morning. Someone at Century House had decided to let him know that SIS had an adult male body to use in Operation Beatrix. Just the sort of thing he needed with breakfast, Basil noted, with a twisted expression. They needed 3, though, one of them a female child, which was really not something to contemplate with his morning tea and Scottish oatmeal. However, it was hard not to get excited about this Beatrix operation. If their rabbit was speaking the truth, not all of them did, this chap would have all manner of useful information in his head. The most useful of all, of course, would be if he could identify Soviet agents within Her Majesty's government. That was properly the job of the security service, erroneously called MI5, but the 2 agencies cooperated closely, more closely than CIA and FBI did in America, or so it appeared to Charleston. Sir Basil and his people had long suspected a high-level leak somewhere in the Foreign Office, but they'd been unable to close in on him or her. So if they got their rabbit out, it wasn't done until it was done, he reminded himself. That was certainly one question his people would be asking in the safe house they used outside of Taunton in the rolling hills of Somerset. "Not going to work today?" Irina asked her husband. "He ought to have left for the office by now, surely."
"No, and I have a surprise for you," Oleg announced.
"What is that?"
"We are going to Budapest tomorrow."
That snapped her head around.
"What?"
"I decided to take my vacation days, and there's a new conductor in Budapest now, Josef Rocha. I knew you liked classical music, and I decided to take you and Zajcik there, dear.
Oh, was all she had to say.
But what about my job at GUM?
Can't you get free of that?
Well, yes, I suppose, Irina admitted. But why Budapest?
Well, the music. And we can buy some things there. I have a list of items to get for people at the center, he told her.
Ah, yes. We can get some nice things for Svetlana, she thought out loud on reflection.
Working at GUM, she knew what was available in Hungary that she'd never get in Moscow, even in the closed stores.
Who is this Rosha, anyway?
He's a young Hungarian conductor touring Eastern Europe. He has a fine reputation, darling. The program is supposed to be Brahms and Bach, I think. One of the Hungarian state orchestras, and, he added, a lot of good shopping.
There wasn't a woman in all the world who wouldn't respond favorably to that opportunity, Oleg judged. He waited patiently for the next objection.
I don't have anything to wear.
My dear, that is why we're going to Budapest. You will be able to buy anything you need there.
Well,
and remember to pack everything you need in one bag. We'll take empty bags for all the things we are buying for ourselves and our friends.
But, Irina, think of Budapest as one big consumer goods store. Hungarian VCRs, Western jeans and pantyhose, real perfume.
You will be the envy of your office at GUM, he promised her.
Well,
I thought so. My darling, we are going on vacation, he told her, a little manly force in his voice.
If you say so, she responded with the hint of an avaricious smile.
I will call into the office later and let them know. I suppose they won't miss me too badly.
The only people they miss in Moscow are the Politburo members, and they only miss them for the day and a half it takes to replace them, he announced.
And so, that was settled. They were taking the train to Hungary. Irina started thinking about what to pack. Oleg would leave that to her.
Inside a week or 10 days, we will all have much better clothes, the KGB communications officer told himself.
And maybe in a month or two, they would go to that Disney Planet place in the American province of Florida. He wondered if CIA knew how much trust he was putting in them, and he prayed, an unusual activity for a KGB officer, that they would perform as well as he hoped.
Good morning, Jack.
Hey, Simon. What's new in the world?
Jack set his coffee down before taking his coat off.
Suslov died last night, Harding announced. It will be in their afternoon papers.
What a pity. Another bat found his way back into hell, huh?
At least he died with good eyesight, thanks to Bernie Katz and the guys from Johns Hopkins, Ryan thought.
Complications of diabetes?
Harding shrugged.
Plus being old, I should imagine.
Heart attack, our sources tell us.
Amazing that the nasty old bugger actually had a heart.
In any case, his replacement will be Mikhail Yevgenievich Alexandrov.
And he's not exactly a day at the beach.
When will they plant Suslov?
He's a senior Politburo member.
I would expect a full state funeral, marching band, the lot, then cremation and a slot in the Kremlin wall.
You know, I've always wondered, what does a real communist think about when he knows he's dying? You suppose they wonder if it was all a great big fucking mistake?
I have no idea.
But Suslov was evidently a true believer. He probably thought of all the good he'd done in his life, leading humanity to the radiant future they like to talk about.
Nobody's that dumb, Ryan wanted to retort. But Simon was probably right.
Nothing lingered longer in a man's mind than a bad idea, and certainly Red Mike had held his bad ideas close to whatever heart had finally cashed in. But a communist's best-case scenario for after death corresponded with Ryan's worst, and if the communist was wrong, then, quite literally, there was hell to pay.
Tough luck, Mishka. Hope you took some sunblock with you. Okay, what's up for today?
The PM wants to know if this will have any effect on Politburo policy.
Tell her no, it won't. In political terms, Alexandrov might as well be Suslov's twin brother. He thinks Marx is God and Lenin is his prophet, and Stalin was mostly right, just a little too nakal-turny in his application of political theory. The rest of the Politburo doesn't really believe that stuff anymore, but they have to pretend that they do.
So call Alexandrov the new conductor of the Ideological Symphony Orchestra.
They don't much like the music anymore, but they dance to it anyway, because it's the only dance they know.
I don't think he will affect their policy decisions a dot. I bet they listen when he talks, but they let it go in one ear and out the other. They pretend to respect him, but they really don't.
It's a little more complex than that, but you've caught the essentials, Harding agreed.
The thing is, I have to find a way to produce 10 double-spaced pages that say it.
Yeah, in bureaucratese.
Ryan had never quite mastered that language, which was one of the reasons Admiral Greer liked him so much.
We have our procedures, Jack, and the PM, indeed all of the Prime Ministers, like to have it in words they understand.
The Iron Lady understands the same language as a stevedore, I bet.
Only when she speaks those words, Sir John, not when others try to speak them to her.
I suppose.
Okay. Ryan had to concede the point.
What documents do we need?
We have an extensive dossier file on Alexandrov. I've already called down for it.
So this day would be occupied with creative writing, Ryan decided. It would have been more interesting to look into their economy, but instead he'd have to help do a prospective analytical obituary for a man whom nobody had liked and who'd probably died intestate anyway.
The preparation was even easier than he'd hoped. Adok had expected the Russians to be pleased, and sure enough, one call to his contact in the Ministry of Transportation had done the trick. At 10 the next morning, he, Paul Matthews, and a Times photographer would be at the Kiev station to do a story about Soviet state rail and how it compared to British rail, which needed some help, most Englishmen thought, especially in upper management. Matthews probably suspected that Haydock was a six person, but had never let on, since the spook had been so helpful feeding stories to him. It was the usual way of creating a friendly journalist, even taught at the SIS Academy, but it was officially denied to the American CIA. The United States Congress passes the most remarkable and absurd laws to hamstring its intelligence services, the Brit thought, though he was sure the official rules were broken on a daily basis by the people in the field. He'd violated a few of the much looser rules of his own mother service, and had never been caught, of course, just as he had never been caught working agents on the streets of Moscow.
"Hi, Tony." Ed Foley extended a friendly hand to the Moscow correspondent of the New York Times. He wondered if Prince knew how much Ed despised him. But it probably went both ways.
"What's happening today?"
"Looking for a statement by the ambassador on the death of Mikhail Suslov."
Foley laughed.
"How about he's glad the nasty old cocksucker is dead?"
"Can I quote you on that?"
Prince held up his scribble pad.
"Time to back up."
"Not exactly. I have no instructions in that matter, Tony. And the boss is tied up on other things at the moment. No time loose to see you until later afternoon, I'm afraid."
"Well, I need something, Ed."
"Mikhail Suslov was an important member of the Politburo and an important ideological force in this country, and we regret his untimely passing."
"That good enough?"
Your first quote was better and a lot more truthful, the Times correspondent observed.
Prince nodded.
Couple of times. Before and after the Hopkins docs, worked on his eyes.
Is that for real?
I mean, I heard a few stories about it, but nothing substantive.
Foley acted the words out.
Prince nodded again. It was true enough. Glasses like Coke bottle bottoms.
Courtly gent, I thought. Well-mannered and all that, but there was a little tough guy underneath. I guess he was the high priest of communism, like.
Oh.
Took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, did he?
You know, there was something of the aesthete about him. Like he really was a priest of a sort, Prince said after a moment's reflection.
Think so?
Yeah. Something otherworldly about the guy. Like he could see things the rest of us couldn't. Like a priest or something.
He sure enough believed in communism. Didn't apologize for it, either.
Stalinist? Foley asked.
No, but 30 years ago he would have been.
I can see him signing the order to kill somebody.
Wouldn't lose any sleep over it.
Not our Mishka.
Who's going to replace him?
Not sure, Prince admitted.
My contacts say they don't know.
I thought he was tight with another Mike, that Alexandrov guy, Foley offered, wondering if Prince's contacts were as good as he thought they were. Fucking with Western reporters was a game for the Soviet leadership. It was different in Washington, where a reporter had power to use over politicians. That didn't apply here. The Politburo members didn't fear reporters at all. Much the reverse, actually.
Prince's contacts weren't all that great.
Maybe, but I'm not sure.
What's the talk here?
Haven't been to the lunchroom yet, Tony. Haven't heard the gossip yet, Foley parried. You don't really expect a tip from me, do you?
Well, we'll know by tomorrow or day after.
But it would look good for you if you were the first reporter to make the prediction, and you want me to help you, right? Not in this lifetime, Foley thought, but then he had to reconsider. Prince would not be a particularly valuable friend, but perhaps a usable one, and it never made sense to make enemies for the fun of it. On the other hand, to be too helpful to the guy might suggest either that Foley was a spook or knew who the spooks were, and Tony Prince was one of those guys who liked to talk and tell people how smart he is. No, it's better for Prince to think I'm dumb, because he'll tell everyone he knows how smart he is and how dumb I am. The best cover of them all, he'd learned at the farm, was to be thought a dullard, and while it was a little hurtful to his ego to play that game, it was helpful to the mission, and Ed Foley was a mission-oriented guy. So, fuck Prince and what he thinks. I'm the guy in this city who makes a difference.
Tell you what, I'll ask around, see what people think.
Fair enough. Not that I expected anything useful from you, Prince thought, a little too loudly. He was less skillful than he thought at concealing his feelings. He would never be a good poker player, the chief of station thought, seeing him out the door. He checked his watch.
Lunchtime.
Like most European stations, Kiev's was a pale yellow, just like a lot of old royal palaces, in fact, as if in the early 19th century there had been a continent-wide surplus of mustard, and some king or other had liked the color, and so everyone had painted his palace that way. Never happened in Britain, thank God, Haydock thought. The ceiling was glass set in iron frames to let the light in, but, as in London, the glass was rarely, if ever, cleaned, and was instead coated with soot from long-gone steam engines and their coal-fired boiler fires. But Russians were still Russians. They came to the platform carrying their cheap suitcases, and they were almost never alone, mostly in family groups, even if only one of them was leaving, so that proper goodbyes could be experienced, with passionate kisses, male to female and male to male, which always struck the Englishman as peculiar. But it was a local custom, and all local customs were peculiar to visitors. The train to Kiev, Belgrade, and Budapest was scheduled to leave at 1 p.m. on the dot, and the Russian railroads, like the Moscow Metro, kept to a fairly precise schedule. Just a few feet away, Paul Matthews was conversing with a representative of the Soviet State Railway, talking about the motive power. It was all electric, since Comrade Lenin had decided to bring electricity and eliminate lice all across the USSR. The former, strangely, had proved easier than the latter. The big VL-80T locomotive, 200 tons of steel, sat at the head of the train on track 3, with 3-day coaches, a dining car, and 6 international-class sleepers, plus 3 mail cars just behind the engine. On the platform were the various conductors and stewards, looking rather surly, as Russians in service-related jobs tended to do. Haydock was looking around, the photos of the rabbit and the bunny seared into his memory. The station clock said it was 12:15, and that tallied with his wristwatch. Would the rabbit show? Haydock usually preferred to be early for a flight or a train, perhaps from a fear of being late left over from his childhood. Whatever the reason, he'd have been here by now for a 1 o'clock train. But not everyone thought that way, Nigel reminded himself. His wife, for example. He was slightly afraid that she'd deliver the baby in their car on the way to the hospital. It would make a hell of a mess, the spook was sure, while Paul Matthews asked his questions and the photographer shot his Kodak film. Finally, yes, that was the rabbit, along with Mrs. Rabbit and the little bunny. Nigel tapped the shoulder of the photographer. This family, approaching now. Lovely little girl, he observed, for anyone close enough to listen. The photographer fired off 10 frames at once, then switched to another Nikon and fired off 10 more. Excellent, Haydock thought. He'd have them printed up before the embassy closed down for the night, get several printed off to... No, he'd personally hand them to Ed Foley and make sure the others went by Queen's Messenger, the Brits' rather more dignified term for a diplomatic courier, so they'd be sure to be in Sir Basil's hands before he turned in. He wondered how they would arrange for hiding the fact of the rabbit's defection. It certainly meant getting cadavers. Distasteful, but possible. He was glad he didn't have to figure out all the details. As it turned out, the rabbit family walked within 10 feet of him and his reporter friend. No words were exchanged, though the little girl, like little girls everywhere, turned to look at him as she passed. He gave her a wink and got a little smile in return. And then they passed by, walked up to the attendant, and showed their paper ticket forms. Matthews kept on asking his questions and got very polite answers from the smiling Russian trainman. At 12:59:30, the conductor, or at least so Haydock assumed from the shabby uniform, walked up and down the side of the train and made sure all the doors but one were secure. He blew a whistle and waved a paddle-like wand to let the engineer know it was time to move off, and at 1 o'clock on the dot, the horn sounded and the train started inching away from the platform, gaining speed slowly as it headed west into the capacious rail yard, heading for Kiev, Belgrade, and Budapest. Chapter 24 Rolling Hills. It was an adventure for Svetlana, most of all, but actually for all of them, since none of the Zaitsev family had ever taken an intercity train. The rail yards on the way out were like any rail yards. Miles of parallel and converging and diverging track packed with box and flat cars carrying who knew what to who knew where. The roughness of the tracks only seemed to increase the apparent speed. Oleg and Irina both lit cigarettes and looked with casual interest out the large but grubby windows. The seats were not unreasonable, and Oleg could see how the beds folded down from the overhead. They had 2 compartments, in fact, with a connecting door. The paneling was wood, birch by the look of it,
and each compartment remarkably had its own lavatory. And so Zaychik would have her very own for the first time in her life, a fact she had yet to appreciate. 5 minutes after leaving the station, the conductor came by for their tickets, which Zaitsev handed over.
"You are state security?" the conductor asked politely.
"So the KGB travel office called ahead for me," Zaitsev thought. "Good of them. That desk-sitter probably really wanted the pantyhose for his wife."
"I am not permitted to discuss that, comrade," Oleg Ivanich answered with a hard look, making sure that the trainman appreciated his importance. That was one way to ensure proper service. A KGB officer wasn't quite as good as a Politburo member, but it beat the hell out of being a mere factory manager. It wasn't so much that people dreaded KGB, but that they just didn't want to go out of their way to come to the agency's adverse notice.
"Yes, of course, comrade. If you need anything, please call for me. Supper is at 18 hours, and the dining car is the next one forward."
He pointed the way.
"How is the food?" Irina decided to ask.
Surely, being the wife of a KGB officer had its advantages.
"It is not bad, comrade," the conductor answered politely. "I eat there myself," he added, which said something, Oleg and Irina both thought. "Thank you, comrade."
"Enjoy your trip with us," he said, and he took his leave. Oleg and Irina both took out books. Svetlana pressed her nose to the window to watch the world passing by. And so the trip began, with only one of them knowing the final destination. Western Russia is mostly a region of rolling plains and distant horizons, not unlike Kansas or eastern Colorado. It was boring to everyone but their Zaychik, for whom everything was new and exciting, especially the cattle that were mainly munching on grass. Cows, she thought, are pretty cool. Back in Moscow, Nigel Haydock thanked the bureaucrat from the Transport Ministry for his splendid help, along with Paul Matthews, and then they made their way off to the British Embassy. The embassy had a photo lab, and the photographer went that way, while Matthews followed Nigel to his office.
"So, Paul, is there a useful story in that?"
"I suppose there might be."
"Is it important that there should be?"
"Well, it's valuable to me that the Sovs should think I can bring attention to the glory of their country," Haydock explained with a chuckle.
"You are a sick chap, aren't you?" Matthews thought, without voicing his suspicion.
"I suppose I can generate something. God knows British Rail needs a boost. Maybe this will encourage the Exchequer to send some more money their way."
"Not a bad idea at all," Nigel agreed.
It was clear that his guest had his suspicions, but had the good grace to keep them quiet, perhaps until a later day, when Nigel was back at a desk in Century House, and they were at a Fleet Street pub.
"You want to see our photos?"
"Would you mind?"
"Not at all. We throw most of them away, as you know."
"Excellent," Haydock announced. Then he reached into the credenza behind his desk.
"Drink, Paul."
"Thank you, Nigel. Yes, a sherry would be nice."
2 sherries later, the photographer came in with a folder full of prints. Haydock took it and leafed through them.
"You do excellent work. You know, when I use my Nikon, I never quite get the light right," he said.
"There, a nice family shot of the rabbit. And, most important, Mrs. Rabbit. There were 3, each one better than the last." He slid them into his drawer and handed the folder back. Matthews took his cue.
"Well, must get back to my office and write this story up. Thanks for the lead, Nigel."
"My pleasure, Paul.
See your own way out."
"Not a problem, old man."
And Matthews and his photographer disappeared into the corridor. Haydock returned his attention to the photos. Mrs. Rabbit was typically Russian, with her round, Slavic face. She could have had 1,000,000 identical sisters throughout the Soviet Union. She needed to lose a few pounds and get a makeover in the West.
If they make it that far, he cautioned himself. Height, about 5'4" or so. Weight, about 140 pounds. Not at all unpleasant. The child, he saw, was darling, with her lively blue eyes and happy expression. Too young to learn to hide her feelings behind a blank mask, as nearly all the adults here did. No, children were the same everywhere in their innocence and insatiable curiosity. But, most important, they now had high-quality photos of the rabbit family. The courier was on the top floor near the office of the ambassador, Sir John Kenny. Haydock passed him a manila envelope sealed by metal clasp, glue, and wax over the flap. The address on the front designated the Foreign Office box that went straight to Century House across the Thames from Whitehall. The courier's bag was an expensive leather attaché case with a coat of arms of the Royal House of Windsor embossed on both sides. There was also a pair of handcuffs for him to secure it to his wrist, despite the stern rules of the Vienna Convention. The Queen's messenger had a car waiting to take him to Sheremetyevo International Airport for the British Airways 737 afternoon return flight to Heathrow. The photos would be in Sir Basil's hand before he went home for the evening, and surely some Century House experts would be staying late that night to go over them. That would be the last official check to see if the rabbit was genuine. His face would be compared with those of known KGB field and security officers. And if there was a hit, then Ed and Mary Foley were in for a bad time. But Haydock didn't expect that to happen. He agreed with his CIA counterparts. This one looked and felt real. But then so did good Directorate II people, didn't they? His last stop was at communications to get a quick message off to SIS headquarters that an important message was en route via courier on Operation Beatrix. That would perk up everyone's eyeballs, and an SIS man would be waiting at the mailroom in Whitehall for this particular envelope. As laggardly as a government bureaucracy could be, Haydock thought, when you had something important to do, it usually got done quickly, at least in the SIS. The flight took 2 hours and 20 minutes, a little late due to adverse winds, before arriving at Heathrow's Terminal 3. There, a Foreign Office representative whisked the courier off to downtown London in a black Jaguar saloon car, and the Queen's messenger made his delivery and went off to his own office. Before he even got there, an SIS officer had taken the package and hustled down to Westminster Bridge and across the Thames. "You have it?" Sir Basil asked.
"Yes, sir."
The messenger passed over the envelope. Charleston checked the closures and, satisfied that it had not been tampered with, slit it open with his paper knife. Then, for the first time, he saw what the rabbit looked like. 3 minutes later, Alan Kingshott walked in. C handed over the color prints. Kingshott took the top photo and gave it a long look. "So, this is our rabbit, is it?" "Correct, Alan," Sir Basil confirmed.
"He looks ordinary enough. His wife as well. The little girl's rather cute," the senior field spook thought out loud. "On the way to Budapest now, are they?"
"Left Kiev station 5.5 hours ago."
"Fast work from Nigel."
Kingshott gave the faces a closer look, wondering what information lay in the brain behind the man's face, and whether or not they'd get to use it.
"So, Beatrix goes forward. Do we have the bodies?"
"The male from York is close enough. We'll need to burn his face off, I'm afraid," C observed distastefully.
"No surprise there, sir," Kingshott agreed.
"What about the other two?" "Two candidates from America. Mother and daughter, killed in a house fire in Boston, I believe. The FBI is working on that as we speak. We need to get this photo to them at once to make sure the bodies match up properly."
"I'll take care of that now, if you wish, sir."
"Yes, Alan, please do that." The machine downstairs was a color photo transmitter like the one used by newspapers.
relatively new, and, its operator told Kingshot, very easy to use. He gave the photo only a cursory look. Transmission to an identical machine made by Xerox and located at Langley took less than 2 minutes. Kingshot took the photo back and returned to C's office.
Done, sir.
Sir Basil waved him to a seat. Charleston checked his watch, giving it 5 minutes because CIA headquarters was a large building, and the communications people were in the basement. Then he called Judge Arthur Moore on the secure, dedicated line.
"Afternoon, Basil," Moore's voice said over the digitized circuit.
"Hello, Arthur. You have the photo?"
"Just got here."
"Looks like a nice little family," the DCI observed.
"This is from the train station."
"Yes, Arthur, they are en route as we speak. They will arrive in Budapest in about 19 hours.
"Okay. Ready at your end, Basil."
"We soon will be."
"There is the matter of those unfortunate people from Boston, however. We have the mail body. It appears on first inspection that it will serve our needs quite well."
"Okay. I'll have the FBI expedite things here," Moore replied. "He'd have to get this photo to the Hoover Building ASAP. Might as well share this grisly business with Emil," he thought.
"Very good, Arthur. I shall keep you posted."
"Great, Baz. See you."
"Excellent." Charleston hung up his phone, then looked over at Kingshot. "Have our people prepare the body for transport to Budapest."
"Timing, sir?"
3 days should be about right," Sir Basil thought out loud.
"Right."
Kingshot left the room. C thought for a moment and decided it was time to warn the American. He punched another button on his phone. This took only a minute and a half.
"Yes, sir," Ryan said, entering his office.
"Your trip to Budapest. 3 days from today. Perhaps 4, but more likely 3.
"Where do I leave from?"
"There's a morning British Airways flight from Heathrow. You can leave from here or just take a taxi from Victoria Station. You'll be accompanied on the flight by one of our people and met in Budapest by Andy Hudson. He's our chief of station there. Good man. Runs a good little station."
"Yes, sir," Ryan said, not knowing what the hell else to say in preparation for his first field mission as a spook.
Then it was time for a question.
"What exactly is going to happen, sir?"
"I'm not sure yet, but Andy has good connections with local smugglers. I would expect him to arrange a crossing into Yugoslavia, and then home from there by commercial aircraft."
"Great. More fucking airplanes," Ryan thought. "Couldn't we take the train?"
But ex-Marines weren't supposed to show fear.
"Okay, I guess that works.
You may speak with our rabbit, discreetly," Charleston warned, "and then you'll be allowed to sit in on our initial debriefing out in Somerset. Finally, I rather expect you will be one of the chaps to escort him back to the States, probably on U.S. Air Force transport out of RAF Bentwaters."
Better and better, Jack thought. His hatred for flying was something he'd have to get over, and intellectually he knew that sooner or later he'd do it. It was just that he hadn't quite gotten over it yet. Well, at least he wouldn't be flying anywhere in a CH-46 with a fluky transmission. He drew the line there.
"My total time away from home?
And sleeping apart from my wife?" Ryan thought.
4 days. Perhaps as many as 7. It depends on how things work out in Budapest," C replied. "That is difficult to predict."
None of them had ever eaten at 60 miles per hour. The adventure for their little girl just got better and better. Dinner was adequate. The beef was about average for the Soviet Union, and so they could not be disappointed by it, along with potatoes and greens, and, of course, a carafe of vodka.
one of the better brands to erase the pain of travel. They were heading into the setting sun, now in country used exclusively for farming. Irina leaned across the table to cut the Zaychik's meat for her, watching their little angel eat her dinner like the big girl she proclaimed herself to be, along with a glass of cold milk.
"So, looking forward to the trip now, my dear?" Oleg asked his wife.
"Yes, especially the shopping."
"Of course."
Part of Oleg Ivanich was calm. In fact, the calmest he'd been in weeks. It was really happening. His treason, part of his consciousness thought of it that way, was underway. How many of his countrymen, he wondered, indeed, how many of his co-workers at the center would take the chance if they had the courage to do so? You couldn't know. He lived in a country and worked at an office where everyone concealed their inner thoughts. And at KGB, even the Russian custom of sanctifying especially close friendships by speaking things that could put you in prison, trusting that a true friend would never denounce you? No. A KGB officer didn't do such things. KGB was founded on the dichotomous balance of loyalty and betrayal. Loyalty to the state and its principles, and betrayal of any who violated them. But since he didn't believe in those principles anymore, he had turned to treason to save his soul. And now the treason was underway. If the second chief directorate knew of his plans, they would have been mad to allow him on this train. He could leave it at any intermediate stop, or just jump off the train when it slowed, approaching some pre-planned point, and escape to Western hands, which could be waiting anywhere for him. No. He was safe, at least as long as he was on this train. And so he could be calm for now, and he'd let the days come as they would and see what happened. He kept telling himself that he was doing the right thing, and from that knowledge came his feeling, however illusory, of personal safety. If there were a God, surely he would protect a man on the run from evil. Dinner in the Ryan house was spaghetti again. Kathy had a particularly good recipe for sauce. From her mom, who didn't have a single drop of Italian blood in her veins, and her husband loved it, especially with good Italian bread, which Kathy had found at a local bakery in downtown Chatham. No surgery tomorrow, so they had wine with dinner. Time to tell her. "Honey, I have to travel in a few days." "The NATO thing?"
"Afraid so, babe. Looks like 3 or 4 days, maybe a little more."
"What's it about, can you say?"
"Nope, not allowed."
"Spook business?"
"Yep." He was allowed to say that.
"What's a spook?" Sally asked.
"It's what Daddy does," Kathy said, without thinking.
"Spook, like in The Wizard of Oz?" Sally went on.
"What?" her father asked.
"The Cowardly Lion says he believes in spooks, remember?" Sally pointed out.
"Oh, you mean The Wizard of Oz. It was her favorite movie so far this year."
"That's what I said, Daddy." How could her daddy be so stupid?
"Well, no, Daddy isn't one of those," Jack told his daughter.
"Then why did Mommy say so?" Sally persisted.
She has the makings of a good FBI agent, Jack thought at that moment. It was Kathy's turn.
"Sally, Mommy was just making a joke."
"Oh." Sally went back to work on her peschetti. Jack gave his wife a look. They couldn't talk about his work in front of his daughter. Not ever. Kids never kept secrets for more than 5 minutes, did they? So, he'd learned, never say anything in front of a kid that you didn't want on the first page of the Washington Post.
Everyone on Grisdale Close thought that John Patrick Ryan worked at the U.S. Embassy and was lucky enough to be married to a surgeon. They didn't need to know that he was an officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. Too much curiosity. Too many jokes.
3 or 4 days, Kathy asked.
That's what they tell me. Maybe a little longer, but not too much, I think.
Important.
Sally had gotten her inquisitive nature from her mother, Jack figured, and maybe a little bit from himself.
Important enough that they're throwing my ass on an airplane, yeah.
That actually worked. Kathy knew of her husband's hatred for air travel.
Well, you have your Valium prescription.
Want a beta blocker, too?
No, thanks, babe. Not this time.
You know, if you got airsick, it would be easier to understand.
And easier to treat, she didn't have to add.
Babe, you were there when my back went out, remember? I have some bad memories from flying.
Maybe when we go home we can take the boat, he added, with some hope in his voice.
But no, it wouldn't work out that way.
It never did in the real world.
Flying is fun, Sally protested.
She definitely got that from her mother.
Travel is inevitably tiring, and so the Zaitsev family was agreeably surprised to see their beds turned out when they got back to their compartments. Irina got her daughter changed into her little yellow nightgown, with flowers on what would have been the bodice. She gave her parents the usual goodnight kiss and climbed onto her bed all by herself. She insisted on doing that, and slid under the covers. Instead of sleeping, she propped her head on the pillow and looked out the window at the darkened countryside passing by. Just a few lights from buildings on the collective farms, but for all that, fascinating to the little girl.
Her mother and father left the connecting door partly open, lest she have a nightmare or other sudden need to get a reassuring hug. Before going to bed, Svetlana had looked under the bed to see if there might be a hiding place for a big black bear, and she was satisfied that no such hiding place existed. Oleg and Irina opened books and gradually nodded off to the rocking of the train.
Beatrix is running, Moore told Admiral Greer. The rabbit and his family are on the train, probably crossing into the Ukraine right about now.
I hate waiting like this, the DDI observed.
It was easier for him to admit it. He'd never gone into the field on an intelligence mission. No, his job had always been at a desk, looking over important information. It was times like this that reminded him of the simple pleasures of standing watch on a ship of war, mainly submarines in his case, where you could look at wind and wave, feel the breeze on your face, and merely by speaking a few words, change the course and speed of your ship instead of waiting to see what the ocean and distant enemy might do to you. You had the illusion there of being master of your fate.
Patience is the hardest of the virtues to acquire, James, and the higher you get, the more you need the bastard. For me, this is like sitting on the bench, waiting for the lawyers to get to the damn point. It can take forever. Especially when you know what the fools are going to say, Moore admitted. He'd also been there and done that, out in the field. But so much of that job was composed of waiting, too. No man controlled his fate, a knowledge that came late in life. You just tried to muddle along from one point to another, making as few mistakes as possible.
Tell the president about this one yet?
Moore shook his head.
No sense getting him overly excited.
If he thinks this guy has information that he doesn't have.
Hell, why disappoint him?
We do enough of that here, don't we?
Arthur, we never have enough information, and the more we get, the more we appreciate what we need and don't have.
James, my boy, neither one of us is educated to be a philosopher.
Comes with a gray hair, Arthur.
Then Mike Bostock walked in.
"Couple more days and Beatrix goes into the history books," he announced with a smile.
"Mike,
Where the hell did you learn to believe in Santa Claus? The DCI asked.
Judge, it's like this. We got us a defector who's defecting right now. We have a good team to get him out of Redland. You trust your troops to do the job you send them out to do.
But they're not all our troops, Greer pointed out.
Basil runs a good shop, Admiral. You know that.
True, Greer admitted.
So, you just wait to see what's under the Christmas tree, Mike? Moore asked.
I sent Santa my letter, and Santa always delivers.
Everybody knows that.
He was beaming at the possibilities. What are we going to do with him when he arrives?
The farmhouse out at Winchester, I imagine, Moore thought out loud. Give him a nice place to depressurize. Let him travel around some on day trips.
What stipend? Greer inquired.
Depends, Moore said. He was the one who controlled that, out of the agency's black budget.
If it's good information...
Oh, as much as a million, I imagine.
And a nice place to work after we tickle all of it out of him.
Where, I wonder, Bostock put in.
Oh, we let him decide that.
It was both a simple and a complex process. The arriving rabbit family would have to learn English. New identities. They'd need new names, for starters, probably make them Norwegian immigrants to explain away the accents. CIA had the power to admit a total of 100 new citizens every year through the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and they'd never used them all up. The rabbits would need a set of social security numbers, driver's licenses, probably driving lessons beforehand, maybe for both, certainly for the wife, from the Commonwealth of Virginia. The agency had a cordial relationship with the state government. Richmond never asked too many questions. Then came the psychological help for people who'd walked away from everything they'd ever known and had to find their footing in a new and grossly different country. The agency had a Columbia University professor of psychology on retainer to handle that. Then they'd get some older defectors to hand-walk them through the transition. None of this was ever easy on the new immigrants. For Russians, America was like a toy store for a child who'd never known such a thing as a toy store existed. It was overwhelming in every respect, with virtually no common points of comparison, almost like a different planet. They had to make it as comfortable for the defectors as possible. First, for the information, and second, to make sure they didn't want to go back. It would be almost certain death, at least for the husband. But it had happened before, so strong was the call of home for every man.
If he likes a cold climate, send him to Minneapolis-St. Paul, Greer suggested.
But, gentlemen, we are getting a little bit ahead of ourselves.
James, you are always the voice of sober counsel, the DCI observed with a smile.
Somebody has to be.
The eggs haven't hatched yet, people. Then we count the chicks.
And what if he doesn't know squat, Moore thought. What if he's just a guy who wants a ticket out?
God damn this business, the DCI completed the thought.
Well, Basil will keep us posted, and we have your boy Ryan looking out for our interests.
That's great news, Judge. Basil must be laughing into his beer about that.
He's a good boy, Mike. Don't underestimate him. Those who did are in Maryland State Penitentiary now, waiting for the appeals process to play out, Greer said in defense of his protege.
Well, yeah, he was a Marine once, Bostock conceded. What do I tell Bob when he calls in?
Nothing, the DCI said at once. Until we find out from the rabbit what part of our comms are compromised, we are careful what goes out on a wire. Clear?
Bostock nodded his head like a first grader.
Yes, sir.
I've had S&T go over our phone lines. They say they're clean. Chip Bennett is still raising hell and running in circles at Fort Meade.
Moore didn't have to say that this alleged claim from the rabbit was the scariest revelation to Washington since Pearl Harbor. But maybe they'd be able to turn it around on Ivan. Hope sprang eternal at Langley, just like everywhere else. It was unlikely that the Russians knew anything his Directorate of Science and Technology didn't, but you had to pay to see the cards. Ryan was quietly packing his things. Kathy was better at it, but he didn't know what he'd need. How did one pack for being a secret agent man? Business suit? His old marine utilities? He still had them, butter bar on the collar and all. Nice leather shoes? Sneaks? That, he thought, sounded appropriate. He ended up deciding on a middle-of-the-road suit and two pairs of walking shoes, one semi-formal, one informal. And it all had to fit in one bag. For that, an L.L. Bean canvas two-suiter that was easy to carry and fairly anonymous. He left his passport in the desk drawer. Sir Basil would be giving him a nice new British one, another diplomatic or fuck-you passport. Probably a new name to go with it. Damn, Jack thought. A new name to remember and respond to. He was used to having only one. One nice thing about Merrill Lynch, you always knew who the hell you were. Sure, Jack's mind went on. Let the whole damn world know you were a flunky of Joe Mueller. Not in this lifetime. Any opinionated asshole could make money, and his father-in-law was one of them. Finished? Kathy asked from behind him. Just about, babe, Jack answered. It's not dangerous, what you're doing, is it? I don't expect it to be, babe. But Jack couldn't lie, and his uncertainty conveyed just enough. Where are you going? I told you, remember? Germany. Uh-oh. She caught me again. Some NATO thing. That's what they tell me. What do you do in London, Jack? Century House. That's intelligence stuff. And Kathy, I've told you before. I'm an analyst. I go over information from various sources, and I try to figure out what it means, and I write reports for people to read. You know, it's not all that different from what I did at Merrill Lynch. My job is to look at information and figure out what it really means. They think I'm good at it. But nothing with guns. Half a question and half an observation. Jack supposed it was from her work in the emergency room at Hopkins. As a group, doctors didn't much care for firearms, except the ones who liked hunting birds in the fall. She didn't like the Remington shotgun in his closet, unloaded, and she liked the Browning high power hidden on the shelf in his closet, loaded, even less. Honey, no. No guns. Not at all. I'm not that kind of spook. Okay, she semi-conceded. She didn't believe him completely, but she knew he couldn't say what he was doing any more than she could discuss her patience with him. In that understanding came her frustration. Just so you're not away too long. Babe, you know I hate being away from you. I can't even sleep worth a damn unless you're next to me. So, take me with you? So you can go shopping in Germany? For what? Dirndl's for Sally? Well, she likes the Heidi movies. It was a weak offering. Nice try, babe. Wish you could, but you can't. Oh, damn, Lady Ryan observed. We live in an imperfect world, babe. She especially hated that aphorism of his, and her reply was an ungrammatical grunt. But really, there was no reply she could make. Minutes later in bed, Jack wondered what the hell he would be doing. Reason told him that it would be routine in every respect, except for the location. But except for one little thing, Abe Lincoln had enjoyed that play at Ford's Theater. He'd be on foreign soil. No, hostile foreign soil.
He was already living in a foreign place, and friendly as the Brits were, only home was home. But the Brits liked him. The Hungarians wouldn't. They might not take a shot at him, but neither would they give him the key to the city. And what if they found out he was traveling on a false passport? What did the Vienna Convention say about that? But he couldn't wimp out on this one, could he? He was an ex-Marine. He was supposed to be fearless. Yeah, sure. About the only good thing that had happened at his house a few months back was that he'd made a head call before the bad guys had crashed the party, and so hadn't been able to wet his pants with a gun to his head. He'd gotten it done, but he damn sure didn't feel heroic. He'd managed to survive, managed to kill that one guy with the Uzi, but the only thing he felt good about was not killing that bastard Sean Miller. No, he'd let the state of Maryland handle that one, by the numbers, unless the Supreme Court stepped in again. And that didn't strike him as very likely in this particular case, with a bunch of Secret Service agents dead. The courts didn't ignore dead cops very often. But what would happen in Hungary? He'd just be a watcher, the semi-official CIA officer overseeing the evacuation of some fool Russian who wanted to move out of his place in Moscow. Damn, why the hell does this sort of thing always seem to happen to me? Jack wondered. It was like hitting the devil's lottery, and his number kept coming up. Would that ever stop? He was paid to look into the future and make his predictions, but inside he knew that he couldn't do it worth a damn. He needed other people to tell him what was happening, so that then he could compare it with things that everyone knew had happened, and then combine the two into a wild-ass guess on what somebody might do. And sure, he'd done okay at that in the trading business, but nobody ever got killed over a few shares of common stock. And now, maybe, his cute little ass would be on the line. Great. Just fucking great. He stared at the ceiling. Why were they always white? Wouldn't black be a better color for sleeping? You could always see white ceilings, even in a darkened room. Was there a reason for that? Was there a reason why he couldn't sleep? Why was he asking damn fool questions with no answers? However this played out, he'd almost certainly be okay. Basil wouldn't let anything happen to him. It would look very bad to Langley, and the Brits couldn't afford that. Too embarrassing. Judge Moore wouldn't forget, and it would become part of CIA's institutional memory, and that would be bad for the next 10 years or more. So, no, SIS wouldn't let anything bad happen to him. On the other hand, they wouldn't be the only players on the field, and, as in baseball, the problem was that both teams played to win, and you needed the right timing to send that 95-mile-per-hour fastball out to the cheap seats. But you can't wimp out, Jack, he told himself. Others, whose opinions he valued, would be ashamed of him. Worse, he'd be ashamed of himself. So, like it or not, he had to suit up and go out on the field and hope he didn't drop the damn ball. Or just go back to Merrill Lynch. But no, he'd rather face bayonets than do that. I really would, Ryan realized, in considerable surprise. Did that make him brave? Or just hard-headed? There's a question, he thought. And the only answer had to come from someone else. Someone who would only see one side of the equation. You could only see the physical part, never the thought that went into it. And that wasn't enough to judge from, much as newsmen and historians tried to shape reality in that way, as though they really understood such things at a distance of miles or years. Yeah, sure. In any case, his bags were packed, and with luck, the worst part of this trip would be the airplane ride. Much as he hated it, it was fairly predictable. Unless a wing fell off. What is this all about? John Tyler asked nobody in particular.
The telex in his hand only gave orders, not the reasons behind them. The bodies had been transported to the city coroner with a request for no action to be taken with them. Tyler thought for a moment and then called the assistant U.S. attorney he usually worked with.
"You want what?"
Peter Mayfair asked in some incredulity. He'd graduated third in his Harvard Law School class 3 years before and was racing up the career ladder at the U.S. attorney's office. People called him Max.
"You heard me. What is this all about?"
"I don't know. I just know it comes straight from Emil's office. It sounds like stuff from the other side of the river, but the telex doesn't say beans. How do we do it?"
"Where are the bodies?"
"Coroner's office, I guess. There's a note on them, mother and daughter, that says don't post them. So I suppose they're in the freezer."
"And you want them raw, like?"
"Frozen, I suppose, but yeah, raw." What a hell of a way to put it, the assistant special agent in charge thought.
"Any families involved?"
"The police haven't located any yet that I know of."
"Okay, we hope it stays that way.
If there's no family to say no, we declare them indigent and get the coroner to release them to federal custody. You know, like a dead drunk on the street. They just put them in a cheap box and bury them in Potter's Field."
"Where are you going to take them?"
"Max, I don't know.
Guess I send a reply telex to Emil and he'll tell me."
"Fast?" Mayfair asked, wondering what priority went on this.
"Last week, Max."
"Okay, if you want, I'll drive down to the coroner's right now."
"Meet you there, Max. Thanks."
"You owe me a beer and dinner at Legal Seafood," the U.S. attorney told him.
Done. He'd have to deliver on this one.
Chapter 25. Exchanging the Bogies. The bodies were loaded in cheap aluminum boxes, the sort used for transporting bodies by air, and then loaded on a van used by the FBI and driven to Logan International Airport. Special Agent Tyler called Washington to ask what came next, and, fortunately, his car radio was encrypted. FBI Director Emil Jacobs, it turned out, hadn't thought things all the way through quite yet either, and he had to call Judge Moore at CIA, where more rapid dancing was done, until it was decided to load them on the British Airways 747, scheduled to leave Boston for London Heathrow, so that Basil's people could collect them. This was done with alacrity because BA cooperated readily with American police agencies, and Flight 214 rolled away from the gate on time at 8:10, and soon thereafter climbed to altitude for the 3,000-mile hop to Heathrow's Terminal 4. It was approaching 5 a.m. when Zaitsev awoke in his upper bunk, not sure why he had done so. He rolled a little to look out the window when it hit him. The train was stopped at a station. He didn't know which one. He didn't have the schedule memorized, and he felt a sudden chill. What if some second chief directorate men had just boarded? In the daylight, he might have shaken it off, but KGB had the reputation of arresting people in the middle of the night, when they'd be less likely to resist effectively, and suddenly the fear came back. Then he heard feet walking down the corridor. But they passed him by, and moments later the train started moving again, pulling away from the wooden station building, and presently the view outside was just darkness again. "Why did this frighten me?" Zaitsev asked himself. "Why now? Wasn't he safe now?" "Or almost so," he corrected himself. The answer was no, not until his feet stood on foreign soil. He had to remind himself of that fact, until he stood on foreign, non-socialist soil. And he wasn't there yet. With that reminder refixed in his mind, he rolled back and tried to get back to sleep. The motion of the train eventually overcame his anxiety, and he returned to dreams that were not the least bit reassuring. The British Airways 747 also flew through darkness, its passengers mainly asleep while the flight crew monitored its numerous instruments and sipped their coffee, taking time to enjoy the night stars and watched the horizon for the first hint of dawn. That usually came over the west coast of Ireland. Ryan awoke earlier than usual. He slipped out of bed without disturbing his wife, dressed casually, and went outside. The milkman was driving into the cul-de-sac at the end of Grisdale Close. He stopped his truck and got out with the half-gallon of whole milk. His kids drank like a Pratt & Whitney engine-guzzled jet fuel and a loaf of bread. He was halfway to the house before he noticed his customer. "Anything amiss, sir?" the milkman asked, thinking perhaps a child was ill, the usual reason for the parents of young children to be up and about at this time of day.
"No, just woke up a little early," Ryan replied with a yawn.
"Anything special you might need?"
"Just a cigarette," Ryan replied, without thinking. Under Kathy's iron rule, he hadn't had one since arriving in England.
"Well, here, sir." The man extended a pack, with one shaken loose. It surprised the hell out of Ryan.
"Thanks, buddy."
But he took it anyway, along with the light from a butane lighter. He coughed with the first drag, but got over it pretty fast. It was a remarkably friendly feeling in the still, pre-dawn air, and the wonderful thing about bad habits was how quickly one picked them back up. It was a strong cigarette, like the Marlboros he'd smoked in his senior year of high school, part of the ascension to manhood back in the late 1960s. The milkman ought to quit, Jack thought, but he probably wasn't married to a Hopkins surgeon. He didn't often get to talk to his customers, either.
"You like living here, sir?"
"Yes, I do. The people here are very friendly."
"We try to be, sir."
"Have a good day, then."
"Thanks, buddy."
"You too," Ryan said as the man walked back to his truck. Milkmen had mostly gone extinct in America, victims of supermarkets and 7-Eleven stores. A pity, Jack thought.